Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. At a time of rising white Christian nationalism in this country, it might be easy to forget that most of the world's peoples are neither white nor Christian. No one knows this better than my colleague, Dr. John Cha, faculty member in the Department of Religion and Japanese Studies program at Gustavus, where he also chairs the Sociology and Anthropology Department. An expert in Buddhism and Japanese philosophy, Professor Cha earned a BA in philosophy from Quincy College and a doctorate in religion from Northwestern University with a concentration in Indian Buddhism. He joined the Gustavus faculty in 1997. A popular professor, and deservedly so, his courses explore world religions, Buddhist philosophy, Zen and Japanese culture, and in a special topics course this spring 2024, yogic philosophy in India, to name just some of what he's taught over the years. Dr. Cha is also an active scholar with numerous conference presentations in the U.S. and abroad, as well as significant publications in an edited volume, the peer-reviewed Journal of Cultural and Religious Theory, and the reference work World Philosophy. Currently, he's undertaking a comparison of the 20th century French philosopher Michel Henry and the 8th century Indian philosopher Shankara. That project is indicative of Professor Cha's intellectual breadth and depth, which is one reason I've been looking forward to our conversation about his work and how he came to it and Gustavus. So, Professor Cha, John, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you on.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Gregory.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, no, it's it's so much. I love getting to talk to, you know, let's face it, we don't get to talk much, right?
Yeah, informally, we're also busy. We focus on community, but we don't have a lot of opportunities, unfortunately.
All well said. Yeah, exactly right. So I like to start with people. I don't know why. People tell me I'm interested in people. I guess I am. Yes, I am. I always like to start with kind of the biography. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your background.
Well, I am a Korean-American. My parents came from Korea in the 50s. My father actually fled North Korea during the communist takeover. Yeah, and so he ended up in DMZ zone, on the South Korean side, working with the Americans actually for a little bit because he knew the terrain and all that. And then landed in Chicago after a few years. And then my mother immigrated from South Korea. And actually went to Coffeyville, Kansas. That's where she started her.
Oh my God.
I know. It was. She told me about it recently. It was a very interesting experience for her. So she went 2 years there and then went to Baldwin Wallace in Ohio.
Nice
college. So anyway, so then I was born when my father was a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago. So I
Go ahead.
No, I grew up in the South Side. Primarily.
Okay. Yeah. So, and I grew up in the South Suburbs, so we were neighbors. Were your parents already married when your dad came, or did they marry here?
No, they actually were. They met in the United States, which is really interesting. Yeah, and then they dated, and they eventually got married.
Yeah, so, that happens.
Yep. Yep.
What was your dad's field? What was he working in?
He's a historian, like yourself.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that. You're kidding me.
Except he does Chinese history, East Asian. His focus was East Asian history and culture.
That is so. This is what I mean about the podcast. So I've known you. I don't know. You've been here since '97.
Yeah, '97.
I don't think I knew that. That is so interesting. Wow. Mm-hmm. So is he retired now, or?
He retired some time ago. He actually passed away in 2018. That's fine. It was. I mean, it's tough, but it was expected at that time.
Yeah. Was your mom working too while she was married? Or?
Yeah, she was actually, you know those fancy charts that doctors need? She worked with some well-known doctors at the University of Chicago. This was Billings Hospital, I believe.
Okay.
And she would do charts. They would, you know, have information and she would need to put it in graph form. So she was, she did that for many, many years.
Isn't that, I've said before in the podcast, this is why I think I love labor history. Or not just labor history, work history. The people, you look at stuff like who invented the toilet paper holder or the chart, right? Who worked on those charts?
Right,
it's so funny.
Right.
Things we see every day. So, you were born. Do you have siblings too?
I have one younger brother. He's about 2 years younger than I am.
Oh, that's like me. I just have the one younger brother who, as I probably have said on the podcast, married Kate, my wife's cousin. They met at her wedding. Mm-hmm. And I called it that night. I knew it was going to happen. Yeah. I didn't know they were going to get married, but I knew they were going to be an item. So
yes.
Yeah. Is your brother an academic? Did he go and follow?
Oh, he went into law. I mean, he was definitely academic material. He loved to do research and he was an English major. But then he got involved with, this was back in the late 80s, a Marxist group, and they were protesting a lot, you know, in South Africa and all that. And he felt that getting a law degree would give him power, more power to actually confront some of the social injustices. So he's very much into, you know, the social justice aspect of this.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my fantasy career. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think about that. Was that in the Chicago area? Is that where he is too?
He went to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Okay. And then he worked as a public defender for 4 years in San Diego, which is tough because that's a very much more Republican leaning. And so,
right.
Yeah. So he had to.
Yeah, from Ann Arbor.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I know. But he had to defend people on the fly. So he learned a lot, you know.
Yeah, I bet. Well, you have an interesting background. So you grew up in the South Side.
Right.
What was that like? Were there particularly, I know I'm asking you to jog your memory, but any memories of that period of your life?
It was very intense. It was very diverse. It was primarily the neighborhood I lived in was primarily African American. And, but we had I had a few friends who were, other Asian Americans, Indian Americans, but primarily African-American. And it was during the 60s. I was born in 62. And so you can imagine what it was like. And there was a Vietnam War
yes,
going.
Yes, I can.
Yeah. And at first I was being picked on, my brother and I, because we were Asian and we were the enemy. Yeah. And you probably remember when Muhammad Ali refused to go to Vietnam.
I sure do.
And he said, you know, the yellow man never called me, and he used the N-word.
Right.
This trickled down to the neighborhood. Believe it or not. And people start shifting their attitude toward me. So instead of being pushed around and bullied a lot, that kind of reduced a little bit.
That's interesting.
Very interesting. I was always been a boxing fan, you know, Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. My brother and I actually boxed for about 2 years in high school.
Gosh.
Yeah, we were Golden Glove fighters.
Oh, my God. I don't, that's funny. I don't think of somehow Buddhism and boxing, but there's probably a connection somewhere.
There is.
That's cool. So, I'm teaching a course right now in 1968. And of course, what we're talking about, you would have been what, six? I don't know. Do you have any memories of that year, 68, the convention or the riots?
Riots and Robert Kennedy and Malcolm X.
Yeah.
I even remember when King was assassinated. I was very little. I was, what, 4 and a half, maybe?
You probably, you've been probably. Yeah, 68.
Yeah, maybe six. Six. And of course, my parents, not typical. They were very liberal Democrats. So I grew up in primarily a liberal household. And I say not typical because a lot of my father's friends from Korean Americans tended to be middle of the road or even Republican. And also the Watergate.
You would remember that for sure. Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm 9 years, I was born in 53, so not that much older than you. But I have vivid memories of the 68. I guess I was 15 already at that point. Good Lord.
Yeah, that was.
I mean, listen, this is another topic, but I may want to have you come into my 68 course. So were you in Hyde Park? Is that where you were, like university area or?
Little bit outside. When I was born, we lived in graduate school housing, but my father moved out. He became a security guard, actually, to kind of supplement the income. And so it was outside the university. And that's why it was pretty tough. If you reside within the university boundaries, it's relatively safe.
Yes. That's why I was asking, actually. Exactly. Yeah. So, did you fight back? Did you fight any bullies who kids who bully?
Three skills you needed. One, to run fast, which that was most of what my brother and I did. You had to be able to fight back. And I did have a few scraps in the neighborhood. And then you have to be able to talk your way out of it. So these skills you kind of just build as a little kid.
Those are life skills, including running. That's amazing. And then talking to our colleague David Obermiller this morning before recording, trying to get some inside info on you, John.
Yeah.
In addition to my due diligence, but he mentioned Carbondale, Southern Illinois. And so tell us a little bit about that. Your family moves there, and that's a place I think of as sorry people from there. And it's just my stereotype of it is, you know, not friendly to people who are not white. But what was that like for you?
Well, it was not too far from Carbondale, but it was actually Quincy, Illinois. It was southwest.
Okay, where you went to college.
Yeah, it was where I went to college. And that's where my father got his first and only college appointment. Anyway, so we were about an hour away from Hannibal, Missouri. So at the time, I heard it's changed, but Quincy was very much almost 90% white, you know, some German Catholics, but mostly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and 10% African-American. And they lived in the middle of Quincy, and it was called the center. I mean, talk about an apartheid-like structure
really?
There. Yeah, and we were only one of two Asian families. So and I was 11 years old. It was during the Watergate fiasco or whatever you want to call it.
Yes,
and,
that's good.
So and in fifth grade, right before we moved, get this is how much things have changed. In Chicago, being the South Side, two fifth grade teachers got together and had the children, the students, put on a short play and then a demonstration against Richard Nixon. So that would never happen today.
No, today you're fired, right? Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, yeah, those were the days.
Those were the days. And we even made we didn't burn anything, but there was a paper mache head and a vampire cape. So we were carrying it. It was crazy.
No, that's
so I was formed politically. So I was uber liberal, you know, anti-corruption, pro-Democrat. And then I moved to Quincy, which is almost 90% of the 90%. The whites there were very conservative Republicans, and I didn't realize that. But I was having lunch with a new friend that I made, and they were all white. And then we were watching the news, and Nixon just resigned.
Okay.
And I just did a yow, yes, and the dirty looks. And that was I stepped in it.
Oh my God! Well, I love that. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So there's a whole topic there. People. Your age and what was the impact of Watergate on them? That's interesting. That is hard to imagine. So the teachers of the school sponsoring.
We marched outside and people were cheering and
anyway, so different. And then I'm imagining like you let out, it's like, you know, one person applauding only, and then everyone So did you remain friends? Can you remember? Did you get over that?
They looked at me and they said, oh, the confused Asian kid, you know.
the crazy liberal from Chicago.
Yeah, that's right.
So what do you know, was the other Asian family, were they Korean also, do you know? Or do you
remember? Chinese American. Okay. And that's there were actually two of them, but there was a Chinese family had a restaurant and they moved. And when I was in high school, another Chinese American family, he was a doctor. And we actually became friends with, his son was right in between my brother and I. So he's a year younger than me and a year older than my brother. So we kind of became friends.
Yeah. So interesting. Mm. And so your dad was teaching history there, it sounds like,
at Quincy College. Yes, and he actually started the Japanese Studies program at Quincy College.
Oh, wow.
And he built a great library. And,
that's fantastic.
Today still go there to do some research because...
Oh, that's amazing. Good for him. Now, I think of Quincy, am I wrong? I think of it as a liberal arts college, more or less. I
mean, it's a small liberal arts college. Catholic.
Okay. Franciscan. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, Catholic, a Franciscan school.
Okay. Yeah, so... let's back up before we get to Quincy. Sure. When you're in high school, I guess what you would have started by the time you left Chicago, right? I'm teasing you sort of, but you know, are you already, you're reading Buddhist texts? I mean, I'm just curious were you drawn to history? What were your interests as a high school kid? Aside from the usual, you know, girls and whatever.
Partying and girls. And I was not very interested in academics. It's kind of strange. Some of it was what I was interested in was actually your field, if anything. It was American history in the 60s and 70s because it was so much a part of my experience.
Makes sense.
We went to a used bookstore when I was a freshman in high school, and there was a copy of Huey Newton's Revolutionary Suicide.
Oh my God, yeah.
And so I just, and my parents kind of struck me like, what is he doing picking up a book? Because I was always playing around and, you know, slacking off. But yeah, it was so absorbing, and you know, just the whole history.
I love that.
And I learned a lot because I remember when I was in Chicago, whenever we'd walk with friends, you know, it'd be two or three, my brother and I, and maybe one other person. But when I walked to school with my African-American friends, there was a huge, like six, seven, eight people at a time. Yeah. And what I found out subsequently, it's directly related to police violence. And then you probably remember back then, it was so blatant in Oakland, right. New York,
yes.
Chicago.
Yes.
Cops would just pick up, especially African-American males, and beat them up, arrest them for no reason. And so
right.
there was this sort of cultural protection that was being formed. And I look back, all these things I was kind of educated on that's become a part yeah. of, I don't even think about it as education. It's just sort of what I grew up with.
And right, so, but it was yeah. education.
Yeah.
I'm kind of thinking how many kids have, you know, or whatever age that was, you pick up your first book in a bookstore, it's Huey Newton's, you know,
yeah,
but the Black Panthers. And, you know, I think of Fred Hampton, who was murdered by the
exactly, yes.
The,
yeah.
the police, the law and order folks.
Yeah, the gunfight, but with all the bullets yeah. going one way.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, horrible, I remember that. Horrible. So yeah. Edward Hanrahan, I think mm-hmm. it was the county attorney. Yeah, just awful. Wow. So you read that book. What else were you drawn to? Any other like in high school? Did you have favorite subjects or favorite courses?
Well,
or?
Yeah. When I was younger, getting into martial arts and trying to protect myself.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Lee was another big influence.
Oh, sure. Oh, of course.
Because when he yeah. came on the scene, it was a popular level. And I would tell little lies when I was in Chicago. I was, what, 10, 9? I said, oh, he's my second cousin. And all the bullies went away. They became my best friends.
Yeah, you can get away with it. That's great. That's excellent.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, man. So I was reading Huey Newton and picking up a little bit of Zen, because Bruce Lee was a philosophy major, actually.
I didn't know that.
And in one of his books he wrote, he had Zen quotes and some quotes from Krishnamurti, an Indian philosopher. So I was kind of indirectly, slowly immersing myself in that without really realizing I was. And then there was an English course, and we learned poetry and Wallace Stevens.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing poet. Order. Yeah, very amazing. And and so that poem, you know, I still remember that poem. And then, of course, you know, Allen Ginsberg, Howl.
Sure. Yeah. yeah. Right.
Yeah. So these are sort of more modern American philosophers.
Yeah.
Poets. I'm sorry, not poets.
And you, but, I mean, and your exposure to political radicalism is interesting.
Oh, I was completely radical. I loved the Black Panthers. I was so angry because they were depicted as nothing but, you know, Black racists, right? And they really developed education programs.
That's right.
Food for children.
Food, the breakfast, I remember. Yeah,
yeah, the breakfast, they organized free food. And actually, white children were invited, the poor whites who were on. So it wasn't just a racial thing. It was more of a justice, including race, but also, as you know, working class issues.
Too. Exactly. It was class as much as, I don't know as much, but certainly class was part of it, not just race. Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you're bringing back lots of memories. Now I need to have you come to my, next time I teach a course on Malcolm X and the work in the Panthers.
Yeah, I would love to. I just told Barbara, I just had coffee with Barbara. And I was saying, if I have time, I'm going to take one of your classes. Because she's so excited about it. So she was telling
me. Oh, Barbara Fleming, who's auditing.
Yes, Barbara Fleming. Great.
She's terrific. Yeah, she and I can provide some real life experience.
Yes,
we talk about the 60s, 68. So, boy, I don't know. How old were you when you were reading Huey Newton? You were you weren't even a teenager, right? You were 11.
Yeah. It was 14.
13, 14, okay.
Yeah, 14 maybe, 15.
I don't, 15. I was reading more like political novels or something. But anyway, for you. So did you... So when you come to Quincy College, and I guess is the choice simply, well, that's where my dad is and I know of it, or did you think of other schools?
I was undecided after high school. Like I said, I kind of bummed around. I just wasn't sure what I wanted. And when I got to Quincy College, the first, semester, I did really well. I changed. I really studied hard. And my parents, of course, being Asian American, and although they were atypical politically, they were more typical in terms of the immigrants. So they said, you have to major, you don't like science too much to go into business. So I majored in accounting, and then transferred to the University of Illinois for two semesters.
Oh,
I got into their business program, which was, So anyway, the reason why I had an interest in philosophy, because one of the first courses I took was a course on ethics. And okay. the professor talked about, you know, Aristotle and ethics and the habitus, how you develop character. And that all speaks to, you know, when you're kind of young and in college.
Sure.
And so I really liked that. And I was thinking about philosophy, but of course, especially my father was like, you don't want to go into philosophy.
Yeah, I'm thinking your dad, right? Like, are you kidding?
He's a humanist, right?
Yeah, and he's a historian, though. Come on. What are you going to do with a history major, Dad? Oh, my God. So I'm trying to imagine you as a boxing. I had never thought of you in boxing together, and now accounting. somewhere you made the right choices. So you mm-hmm. went there, and then you transferred back to Quincy, right? After
a year, I decided not to do accounting, and then I decided on philosophy. But I knew some of the professors at Quincy, and plus I didn't want to go into debt, and because my father was working there, I could just go for free, and sure. I wanted a different atmosphere. I mean, U of I back then, University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, was 50,000 students.
Yeah, it was huge.
And I just did not like that setup.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Quincy's more like Gustavus. Yeah,
I didn't. I mean, I guess I wish I'd gone to. I applied to, what was the, was it McMurray in Illinois? McMurray? Or a couple of, in Eureka, I think, where Reagan went, maybe. A couple of small colleges I applied to, but I wound up going to Northern Illinois University just because, I mean, honestly, partly because some friends were going to the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I thought, I'll just be different. But also, it was smaller. I mean, it was still a big state school, but not as big as U of I. Yeah. So back to Quincy. And then is that when you decided to major in philosophy by the time you came back?
I decided before. And when I came back, I just immediately signed up.
Okay.
And
went right into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And were your parents eventually, did they make their peace with that?
Yeah. I mean, they had to. I mean, the other choice I had was to join the army.
Oh, God.
Oh, and so they were like, no, you're not going to do that. So actually, it turned out well after when I finished, you know, I did well. And my professors liked me. I love my professors, obviously. They were just really good instructors, teachers. And then my parents were just very happy. At least I found something.
Right. Yeah.
Their big fear was I would just kind of wander around for 10 years, not knowing what I wanted to do.
Box your way across the country. So,
exactly.
Yeah, now I imagine an alternative life for you where you go into the military, you're boxing in the army, and then, I don't know, you become special forces, and then retire as an accountant or something. Strange. Yeah. So, what about graduate school? Mm-hmm, how did mm-hmm. you? Mm-hmm. I don't even remember my own case. I do remember actually. It was a professor who was kind of a mentor, historian when I was an undergraduate who encouraged me. I didn't have academic parents. I'm kind of first gen, college first gen. But did you? Do you remember, like, at what point I'm going to graduate school, I want to keep doing philosophy?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to because I couldn't. What job can you get with philosophy? It wasn't quite career, though. I was thinking more of actually becoming a college professor. I did a little bit tutoring when I was majoring in philosophy. There were a couple of first years who needed help, and I could take them through Plato and Aristotle, explain what's going on. And so I really enjoyed that. And so I thought, you know, I want to give this college teaching a try. And that's part of the reason why I decided to go to grad school. And of course, I was doing Western philosophy and there was no course on Eastern philosophy at all. I mean, during those times, especially.
At Quincy, right?
Yeah, Quincy. I think there's maybe one subsection of world religions and a world philosophy course. And I really wanted to dig my teeth, especially I was doing reading outside, you know, by myself.
Yeah.
And when I went, I was going to go to Indiana, University of Indiana. Didn't get into Harvard or Chicago. No, I didn't apply to Chicago because my father forbade me because he was a product of Chicago. He just didn't think it was a good place. I mean, I think it's great. I don't have that, perspective, but he did. So I didn't get into Harvard or Stanford. I got into Indiana and a couple others. And I went actually because it was, maybe 6-hour drive from Quincy, 7-hour drive. So I went there and interviewed with the department and I really liked them. And they actually encouraged, if I wanted to do comparative. And that's what I was hoping to do. And then there was actually one professor from Tokyo University who was a master. And I call him the master, the maestro, because he knew eight languages.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so that was the tough part of grad school was I needed to learn the classical languages to ask you about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So Sanskrit and when?
Sanskrit.
And
Yeah, okay. So if you study Indian Buddhism, the problem is, especially Indian Buddhist philosophy, so many of the texts are lost. And so you have Tibetan, classical Tibetan translations, classical Chinese translations. And then you have to know, I listed Pali there. That's
right.
That's just the early Pali canon was written in that language. So I had to study that. And so I had a choice, either Tibetan or Chinese. And I chose Tibetan because I love the script. That's a strange. And then he suggested I learn both. And I said, well, I want to get my PhD before I'm 50. So let me just, so I stuck to that. And it was great though. I struggled through the two languages, but by the time I got to the point where after my comps, I would just go to his house once a week and we would read fragments of Sanskrit texts, and we would have maybe two editions of the Tibetan translation. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. So I learned how to appreciate how to read these classical texts and their commentarial structure and what kind of philosophical issues they were dealing with. So
it's one-on-one tutorial, basically.
Yeah, it was just absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
The and Northwestern, I'm so pretty. I love that. Great history department too. Did you take any history courses while you were there or not?
No, but one of the professors was he was a historian, although he did Catholic history.
Okay.
So I think I took a course from him. They also had a really good phenomenology philosophy department, and they focused on phenomenology. And the weird thing was I sat in on one seminar, but I didn't take advantage of that because I was so immersed in the languages.
Huh.
And so I would go to like guest speak. They would invite people for like public lectures.
Sure.
I would go to
those.
But, yeah. It wasn't until I got to Gustavus that I decided to really dig in and really read all the classics of phenomenology and interpretations.
Yeah. I want to ask you, we're going to come back to phenomenology when we talk about your current work, mm-hmm. and then you can give us a definition then, a word that may scare people. But so can you say more about your, you mentioned earlier the Western philosophy, the stuff about ethics and how that could be attractive to young, especially given when you were growing up, what was going on in the world.
Right.
But what was it, beyond just you had some acquaintance with, Zen Buddhism, what was it that drew you to that? Because that's your concentration, right? Indian Buddhism in Northwestern?
Indian Buddhism.
What was it about that?
Well, in terms of what I was looking for, I never grew up in an Asian American community. So I had really no ties, ethnic ties.
Right.
And so I was always in some diverse setting, whether it's an African American neighborhood in Chicago and predominantly white in Quincy. And something I should mention, when I went to Quincy and my first friends were, what they used to call the popular crowd. I don't know if you remember, they were all different groups. So
of course.
You had your popular crowd.
I longed to be in it.
Athletes and musicians. And so my first few friends were of that group, the popular group. But by that time, I was so politicized in terms of my experience in Chicago, I just couldn't stand them, And so I made friends with working class whites and with African Americans in Quincy.
Huh.
The only problem was, and they're all working class, which is interesting, but the problem was, given the racial tensions, there were serious racial tensions, fights, and there was a couple of years before I came to Quincy, I heard there was a race riot in the high school. This is all hearsay, so I don't know if that actually happened, but there was a lot of talk about that.
Yeah.
And I experienced that firsthand in trying to navigate between having friends who hated each other based on race. And so I guess my point is that I never felt at home. I was always in the margins or in between, the interstices, as they say. And so I think my part of what attracted me to Buddhism, it was, on the one hand, it stressed the mindfulness in the particular moment, but it also gave a philosophy that was more universal. And part of it might have been finding an identity, So Western philosophy helped with the existentialism, a lot of college students are really excited about Nietzsche and Sartre.
Right, exactly.
And so I fell into that too. But I was really looking for bridges, connections to make, some sort of larger foundation. So That was, I think, and I didn't realize it at the time, but when I reflect back, that was certainly a part of why I wanted to pursue philosophy. You know, it's the big questions, right?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, in retrospect, of course, we don't realize a lot of these things at the time. But yeah, before we come back to Buddhism, I'm just wondering. So, as an Asian American kid in that context, let's say in Quincy, how are both whites and blacks thinking of you, referring to you? Are you considered black? Are you considered? I mean, did they use derogatory names to?
It was a highly racialized environment, so derogatory names are just thrown like second nature. I mean, it's so different now, in some quarters at least. I couldn't be placed because they knew I was Asian, but the race in that context was white and black.
Right.
Black friends, they considered me a person of color. And so I was treated like, I'm like you, maybe not exactly, but they understood. And some of the racial issues I was dealing with many of the whites I was dealing with, you know, I was encountering and engaging with, they completely understood. But I had sympathy for the white students too, because they were working class. And I could get along with them, and I kind of quasi understood where they were coming from. So it was a very strange time when I look back.
Yeah, but what an interesting, it's fascinating. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you wanted to design an independent study, right, in identity and race, you were living it, right? Totally.
Yeah, yeah,
so interesting. Yeah. So were you already doing boxing as a kid at that point too, or not?
No, I learned I did some martial arts, some taekwondo and karate. And my father, because he was into Korean War, he learned how to fight. So he taught me a few things, some judo moves and how to throw a good punch.
Okay.
So, but it wasn't until I was in high school. So my brother and I joined a wrestling team in Quincy High.
Okay.
But during the end of my sophomore year, beginning of the police athletic league opened up.
Oh, wow.
And so we were both boxing fans. So we just quit wrestling and went to the boxing center.
That's amazing.
It was.
Do you still do any of this stuff? I mean,
I don't. I don't fight anymore, obviously, but I do. I mean, to keep in shape, I have a speed bag in the attic and little things like that, but nothing heavy, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know you are in good shape. I wish I were in that kind of shape, but that's another podcast. So you're at Northwestern, you're looking at doing work in Indian Buddhism, and you finish your PhD, obviously. Right. What's the path, and we'll come to your work on Buddhism in a bit, but what's your path from there to Gustavus? Is it literally like, I get my PhD from, I was ABD, actually, even when I was hired at Gustavus. Mm-hmm. I was looking, and then I hadn't even heard of Gustavus. I don't know about you. I'd heard of Carleton growing up in the Chicago line. But how'd you get here? What brought you here?
Well,
aside from the job, yes, of course.
Yeah, I was on the job market for a while because at Northwestern, they had a dissertation year scholarship. And I think 3 years of being a TA, and because of the budget cuts in the late 80s, those two went. So I only had 2 years of being a teaching assistant and no dissertation year scholarship. And so I had to start teaching. So I hobbled together. I taught, there was a Oakland Community College. Illinois. So I taught a couple of sections of world religions there. And then I would take the train back into the city. And there was a Northwestern City College in the city. And so I was teaching between those two. So I was doing the migrant academics.
Right.
So I
did that this about, is- yeah. Sorry, is this while you're also trying to finish your dissertation?
Yes.
Or you're already,
Yes.
That's a lot. That's a lot. Migrant scholar. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, so that was, but the good point was I had a lot of teaching experience before I even finished my dissertation.
Yes. Same here. That saved me in this job. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. For a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. It helped me get the job, probably in your case too.
Yeah.
It also helped me stay somewhat sane. I wasn't having to start from scratch.
And so I guess they were actually looking for, the religion department was looking for somebody in Theravada Buddhism, which is Southeast Asian, but also Japanese Buddhism. Okay. So they were looking for that. But I was didn't quite fit, but at least back then, this is before, you know, the electronic age, I guess, that you go to these conferences, you fill out cards saying you'd be interested. Yes. And so I filled out about 50 of them. So, and I had a lot of interviews for like 2 and 3 year positions. And then I got a note from the then chair. You probably remember Conrad Hires.
I sure do.
Yeah. So he wanted to see me. And I said, we really actually ran into each other. I said, well, I have another interview, which is really silly because this is for tenure track. But I didn't say anything more. He thought I was the hottest ticket in town or something because he was thinking, oh, my goodness, all these people, we better get him, you know. So I got this I got an interview with him, which lasted a long time. And then I interviewed with the other two, Marsha Bunge and Garrett Paul.
Garrett Paul, who grew up in he grew up in Creed, I think Creed, which is one of the Chicago suburbs,
not far from another Chicago.
And I believe, if I remember correctly, Garrett's mother, at some point, was at least for a time, or at least once, had her hair done by my hairdresser dad, who had salons in the summer. We're all connected.
Marsha Bunge is a product of the University of Chicago.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
School, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that she does have that connection. Yeah. So you interviewed, and then they call you to campus, I assume, for more.
Yes.
Were you at all, as I said, I had not heard of Gustavus, and I saw an ad. Okay, you weren't aware. And I did a little, it couldn't have been the Google. I don't know what I did to find out. Well, one thing is I ran into my advisor and I said, I'm going to interview with this school, Gustav. I didn't even know how to pronounce it. And he said, excellent college, and he said, he mentioned Jim McPherson, who's still the great living Civil War historian who went here, and Sidney Ahlstrom, who's a great American religious prof who taught my advisor, one of his profs at Yale. And as soon as I heard that, I God, I want this job. Because I'd read McPherson. I had to read Ahlstrom for my orals, my PhD. But and so that's how I interviewed. I don't know about, but what I was going to ask you, where I was going with this is, I was baptized in the Greek Orthodox Church on my dad. I don't remember. All I remember about, I remember once going to Greek Mass as a kid, a teenager. And all I remember, honest to God, is the communion was real bread. Which I thought was wow. And, real wine, not grape, just okay, this I can deal with.
Yeah.
But anyway, Episcopalian. And I didn't understand, I didn't know ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Right. And the word evangelical, frankly, scared the hell out of me.
Yes.
Pun intended. Did you have any, was that a part of your thinking at all? Do you have any concerns about that? What kind of, is this a church related college or a college of the church or et cetera?
Well, I wasn't too concerned because previously I interviewed at a couple other places. One of them was a church-related college that I somehow heard, and I forget how, that it was, more not conservative, but among the evangelical groups, it was more conservative than, let's say, Swedish Lutheran. So they have a Norwegian Lutheran, a Swedish. And so I kind of, once I applied to Gustavus and had that interview, I looked into it more, and it was Swedish Lutheran. I thought, well, that'd be interesting, and I wasn't too worried.
Yeah.
And when I got here, of course, I had no worries about.
Same here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once I met everybody, and it's funny for me, a big draw was the Swedish connection because somehow. Again, being just a little older than, Sweden meant, they were opposed to the war in Vietnam. I love Swedish movies already at that point, it seemed, this is cool. I can get into that. And they had the peace studies, which we still do program, and I liked all of that. So before we turn to your teaching, which I do want to talk about, because you're such an excellent teacher and your courses are so interesting, tell us a little bit about your research, where you're add in that if you're willing to. Some people don't like to talk about current work and kind of both what it is but also what it grows out of, how it relates to previous work, and then at some point define for us what phenomenology is.
I will give it a shot. I was exposed to some existentialism philosophy as an undergraduate, and the very controversial philosopher Martin Heidegger really, really piqued my interest. And he did some work with, he had Japanese students. I don't know if you knew that, but
I did not know that. No,
I yeah, there were. I mean, this was a time when Japan was already modernized, and they were trying to look for something to reestablish their roots and culture. And of course, Heidegger is all about that, right? The being in the world, and you're in a culture, you're in a society, and how do you live authentically, and all that. And he was Heidegger was the student of Edmund Husserl, who was the so-called father of phenomenology. So
okay.
Once I began reading Heidegger, he did a lot of work with the Japanese students who were Zen Buddhists, but also he was working with a Chinese scholar on Taoism. He was very interested in
Chinese. Wow, I did not know any of that. Huh.
Oh, yeah. He was, especially later after the denazification and when he finally returned back to teaching for a little while, he was really into a philosophy of literature, like poetry and art, and he was delving very deeply in the Eastern traditions. And so that was part of my interest in all this.
Do you know if he went to Japan or China or both?
I'm trying to think. I don't believe he did. Yeah, okay. I don't believe he did.
No, I didn't know that at all. Yeah. I didn't know that about him at all.
Yeah, and also he's – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, about Heidegger, it's interesting because, he was a major intellectual force in the Iranian Revolution. Isn't it?
Also very interesting. Yes.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Because of course, right. The Iranian intellectuals looked at the United States as this neoliberal hegemonic power.
Yes.
How do you resist that? And I think Heidegger has very powerful language where you can root yourself back in tradition, but for the future.
Yeah.
And of course, when you think about his philosophy and then his connections with Nazism, it can go very badly, which it did for him. I mean,
I was wondering when that was going to come up, and how were you going to put it? And it can go very badly. Yeah.
Yeah, and because there have been so much. Comparative philosophical works on Heidegger and Zen, Heidegger and Taoism and deconstruction and all that. I thought, well, that would be great, but I kept running into problems. And I will work my way to Henri eventually, but
no, it's fine.
Very quickly, wrestling with Heidegger, because although I appreciated his philosophy and there were definitely parallels, you can't reconcile his notion of, you've heard Dasein, right?
His notion
of Dasein and being in the world. And that just in the end didn't fit. And so I had this great idea. I was going to do Indian Buddhism and some how it influenced some Shankara and his Hindu philosophy and look at Heidegger as a Western counterpart. And it just didn't fit.
Wasn't working. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just strange because usually you can find somebody. I couldn't find the fit. And then I heard on a YouTube video of this French philosopher who was very famous in France, but until 10 years ago, wasn't really known in the United States. And he was, but he was not a big name at all here in the United States. And
right. I only know him from very, and he's passed away, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Some time ago.
But anyway, I sure had not heard of him until very recently. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. So you came across him on a YouTube video? Was it him speaking or was it?
Well, it wasn't him speaking. It was a scholar who's a theologian, and he's talking about the theological turn in France. There was an assessment, I'm getting into the weeds here, but there was an assessment done on the state of phenomenology and philosophy in France. And in the 1990s, Dominique Janicot, who's a very well-known classical phenomenologist, said, France is taking a wrong turn. They're bringing in religion and God into the phenomenology. And he said, this is a secular method. It's not, you don't talk about God and presence and prayer.
Not in France.
And definitely not in France. But that kind of actually brought these thinkers like Michel Henry into prominence. Okay. And when I read after I listened to this YouTube, I did some research on his biography, and actually he was born in Haiphong, Indochina, in 1922. And he moved back, his father died there, and he moved back to France with his mother when he was like 8 or 9. And he was actually involved, given his age, in the French resistance against the Nazis.
Oh, wow.
And he was, that's already a for me, a plus. Right?
Well, yeah, I'm thinking it's in some ways you, right? Mm-hmm. The identities and the moon. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Except he was a spy for them. Huh. And he really had to learn how to, you know, be a quote unquote French sympathizing Nazi and gather information. It's very dangerous work. And he had his own rootedness in, you know, in Western philosophy and phenomenology. So out of that came this notion of the sense of the interior. You know, what is an authentic way of being in the world, even though you have to wear masks?
Right.
Basically. Yeah. And so he was very much into the idea of awareness and interiority, what he calls the internal structure of immanence. I know I'm getting into the weeds now, but that's...
No, it's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, and it's actually just reminding me of... W.E.B. Du Bois and this idea of doubleness, you know, that African Americans, so you're wearing a mask and keep going. And I do want you to define phenomenology at some point, because that's what Henri really is, right?
He is. So anyway, he really was well known in France because his dissertation, which is like almost 1,000 pages, was published.
Good Lord.
And that cemented his reputation in France, and he was invited by the Sorbonne to teach. He refused because he thought that it was too glitzy. I don't know if I'm misrepresenting that, but this is just my interpretation. He wanted to focus on phenomenology, and already, deconstruction and post-structuralism was the fad, and he really wanted nothing to do with fads. He wanted to go deep into this notion of subjectivity, and that's why he stayed with the so-called phenomenological tradition.
Which is what? Give us a definition.
I guess one way to put it, and there are a lot of different definitions, obviously, by any philosophical method, but phenomenology literally is the study of phenomena, how what appears to us and how we understand the world. And so it's very much centered around human experience. And one strain of this, so-called reflective or classical phenomenology, is to try to understand the structures of consciousness, how we make sense of the world as we move about, as we live our life. And so it's kind of not an introspection, but it's an investigation into how we construct meaning, how we live meaningfully in life.
How we know stuff, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, how do we know? How do we understand? Yeah. What do we bring to any situation? How are we interpreting the situation? And it's a way of understanding the root structures, the so-called transcendental structures of experience. So we may begin to understand in deeper ways, more profound philosophical ways, the ways we create meaning in the world. And with others too. It's not a solipsistic philosophy. It's about being in the world.
With other...
With community, culture. And what really got to me about Henri was he was looking past previous phenomenologists who talked about, for instance, consciousness is structured as intentionality. Whenever I'm conscious of something. And so what we want to do is understand the meaning we have between the subject and whatever object we're looking at or whatever the intended object is. And he was claiming that prior to that, there is a level of appearance and consciousness, which is really subjective. That is the sort of the foundation of what it means to be human, how we eventually create meaning, how we interact with others. And as I was reading him, and I just started reading him about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago.
Okay, recently, yeah.
Yeah, my daughter bought me a copy of the English translation of his dissertation, The Essence of Manifestation. I don't know, I didn't know this, but she spent $300 on this.
Oh my God.
So I had to read it. So
yeah, you have to read it.
I have been just reading most of his, the primary works and then secondary literature. And the reason I am interested in that subjectivity is because Buddhism, as well as the Shankara, the Hindu philosophy, the Indian philosopher I'm focusing on, deals with an analysis of the construction of how we see things, which is very parallel with phenomenology. And so what I'm trying to do is to first compare the two, see where there are influences, not influences, see where there are commonalities and distinctions but it's more of a constructive work. And this is very vague because I'm just starting the writing.
Yeah, you're early on, right?
Very early on. But how can a non-Western classical Indian philosopher influence what we understand as Western phenomenology? Because the other side of this is that we are in a world where we are engaging, confronting, interacting with people of all different contexts, ethnic roots, histories, cultures. And, you know, if there's a fault in Western academic philosophy is, aside from maybe two or three institutions, it's almost exclusively Western.
Western, yeah.
Yeah, and in the 21st century, you know, come on.
Right.
This is, you know, it's gone on too long. People were already complaining in the 90s that it's so insular.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, 21st century now. It's still like that.
Well, is Shankara, now I will confess, I had not heard of Shankara until I was preparing for our conversation. So is he well known, Shankara, among, I mean, outside of, yes. I mean, would Henri have studied him or known about him?
No, that's the one thing. Unlike Heidegger, who ventured into Eastern and Asian thinking, Henri stayed completely in the Western tradition. That's why I find it so fascinating that there are connections. Shankara is a 8th century, depending on which scholar you talk
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I saw that there's debate about when, 8th or 9th,
But he's very well studied. For some reason, the German idealists, I mean, they were exposed to, you know, Hindu literature, you know, in the 18th, 19th century. And so already they had, like Schopenhauer, he wrote his book.
Oh, yeah, sure, okay.
Yeah. It's largely based on Buddhism and Hinduism. And so in the 19th and especially post, you know, post-independence in India, there was a lot of philosophical work trying to connect Indian philosophy with Western philosophy. And Shankara was one of the main figures that has been studied, both by, you know, the Indian scholars, but also German, French, and American scholars.
Okay.
And so he's well known in academic circles in terms of, you know, Asian philosophy and comparative philosophy.
Well, you just used the word comparative again, and that is something I want to work this into the conversation because it is something I admire about your work, and that's evident in this project. You know, taking seemingly two very disparate, thinkers, philosophers, and you teach I know you believe by all of your colleagues in studying religion comparatively, right? Mm-hmm. That's a part of your department. So I just want to say, I think that's really, that speaks to me. I love doing that kind of comparisons, especially across seemingly different, disparate things, whatever those things might be, ideas or, you know, objects, it doesn't matter. So I really like that. It sounds extremely interesting. Are you having to read Shankara in its original language, his original, are there English translations to those work? It's in Sanskrit. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. There are a lot of translations, which is good. It speeds up the process. But yes, I did find some edited volumes. I actually ordered books from India, like, you know, several years ago. And so I have his complete works. He was a basic commentator on early Indian religious literature.
Okay.
And then he wrote his own one text on his own, which is verses and a couple of prose essays. But yeah, I'm reading them in Sanskrit because during my time at Northwestern, I realized, and as I read English translations, there's just no way to really understand.
It's not the same, right?
Yeah. It's just not the same. And
yeah,
now,
this is, you know,
I'm not a Sanskritist, but I read all, you know, philosophical Sanskrit for so long that it wasn't a stretch for me to begin reading Shankara. So it took me a couple of years to kind of get used to the change in technical languages. But it's actually fun for me, fun reading just to
that's
aside
cool.
from research.
It's great. And it's also, you know, just a reminder about even languages today, right? It's, I mean, so what do I need to learn any other language? I mean, everyone speaks English, but how can you learn a culture if you don't know the language, it seems to me?
Exactly.
So good luck with that project. It really does sound fascinating.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I think Michelle Henry, at least the photos, I may have seen the same video you're talking about, by the way, in preparing for this podcast, but he looked like a cool dude to me. I don't know what it was. There's something about him. And I thought, this guy looks interesting. I want to talk to this guy. And we don't know, I'm sure, what Shankara looked like, right? We have no idea.
We have these very, these religious paintings.
Okay.
And they tend to put halos and he's.
Oh, yeah.
And also the biographies are just all, you know, hagiographies. So it's hard to. Okay. Hard to get a concrete historical sense of who he was because they're all
it's so cool. It's so cool to imagine like putting these two guys together if you could, right? You're going to do that in your work, but
I hope to.
You will. In addition to, and you know, you've done more scholarship than I have, God knows. But how do you, I mean, so on top of that, you're also teaching. Obviously, fundamentally a teaching institution, although more and more faculty are doing really good and important research, you among them. But God, all of your courses sound so interesting to me. And it's the honest to God truth. Students, I mean, unsolicited, if I say, what are you taking? You know, oh, John, oh my God, I love, you know, they just love, you know, you're, no, they love
thank
your courses.
Thank you. I appreciate
that's
that.
That's the truth. Yeah. But is there a particular course you really enjoy more than the others, or one? I mean, I noticed you teach Buddhist philosophy. I think I mentioned the intro and Zen and Japanese culture. Are there are those courses that really appeal to you? And I'm curious too about student reaction. I mean, I'm assuming maybe I'm wrong that most of the students taking courses in your department would most, not all, self-identify as Christian, but take all those questions, comments, wherever you like.
Sure. My favorite ones are the 300 level. I mean, I enjoy teaching all the courses, but it's in the 300 level that you get to do a deep dive.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
Really, and a part of the reason I'm interested in comparative is because I have to use Western concepts in the beginning to make some sort of connection to bring the students into the world of Shankara, for instance. So we're going to, like in this semester, we're going to start reading Shankara in maybe 3 weeks. And why I like phenomenology, because you begin with human experience.
Right.
And so when I begin teaching a course, I have the statue of Ganesh, the Hindu god. Elephant head. Interesting. Interesting how I got it. But anyway, so I have them look at it and then I turn it around and I give them a very concrete way of understanding what a phenomenologist would do, for instance.
Okay.
You know, analyzing that we have a sense that we perceive an object as it is, but our perceptions are only facades. We only see anything at one perspective. We never see the whole thing because we can't, right?
Right.
But our minds create this idea, a meaningful idea of seeing the object as it is in full, its full meaning and significance. So I use a lot of concrete phenomenological analyses to bring them into what's going on when you experience anything. And then I can make connections with, when the Hindus or the Buddhists say this, you know, what do you think they're experiencing? Why would they talk about the interrelatedness of all things? And I have them think about that. And so it's a good way to use Western concepts in the beginning and then kind of do a switch, bait and switch.
It's perfect.
And I tell them I'm doing that. It's and it's strange because they're like, this is interesting, but it's so different. And by a month into the course, they're getting it for the most part.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here. Yeah. That's so satisfying, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sitting here smiling because it's a course I want to take now. Mm-hmm. First of all, it sounds like it's, I mean, all this stuff about experience and conscious, all I just find absolutely fascinating. I don't know. I'm not a philosopher, but you know, it's psychology. It's now it could be neuroscience, philosophy, all that stuff. What, just quickly, because you mentioned, I can't let you go. So what's the story? How did you get the object mentioned?
Okay. Yeah. So when you're looking at it and I start turning it, I said, just reflect on what's happening. You see only one facade, but as I turn the object, you see a new side of the object, right? But you have to remember the previous side of the object, right? And then you have to anticipate what it's going to look like as a 3D object I'm holding in front of you. So already the notion of time, the past remembrance, the present perception, and the anticipated future. And when I say past, present, future, we're talking momentary, obviously, when I'm just turning.
You're talking history. Come on, man. You're talking history.
Right? This is history.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a temp, both a structural and a temporal process we go through. So I want to get this in their heads that our consciousness is active. We're not simply looking at something as it is. And of course, right. This would fit in history. When you when you see the words Black Panthers and if you have any idea,
yes,
you're going to have perceptions about them. Well,
that's right.
What's underneath the perceptions? Why do you think they're, black racists or whatever you want to call it, whatever they were labeled, and look underneath what's happening. So it's kind of a more of a philosophical perceptual analysis, which is analogous to history and culture. And
absolutely.
So there are a lot of connections.
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
And people have actually used phenomenology when analyzing race and gender and social justice and these types of things.
I love all this stuff. And literally just today I was exhorting one class to consider perceptions and their role in history, and that perceptions, granted, it's not exactly what, but it certainly overlaps. Perceptions really, sometimes perceptions matter more than the, what the reality is, right?
Isn't that something? Yeah.
If you think a Black Panther is, violent and, racist against whites, then whether that's true or not, right, that affects your behavior, and God knows it affected the police's behavior.
Yes, exactly.
So, it's all interesting. Your courses are interesting. The as we wind down here, I want to give you a chance, as I'd like to do all colleagues, to make the case, the elevator pitch, if you like, for both your discipline, but also liberal arts college, which seems to be maybe an endangered species.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure. Invented in this country. Yeah. Sure. But what's your case for? I mean, why should people have to take any religion courses or want to take any religion courses? And what about a place like Gustavus, a liberal arts college? What is its value in your mind?
Right. Well, there are so many values I see, but just specifically, religion courses generally, first of all, 85% of the world, they identify as religious. It's not so much, of course, in Northern Europe, and kind of becoming less so maybe in the United States. So just understanding religion itself is a way of communicating with other people.
Okay.
And so there's a very strong intercultural aspect to studying religion. And also understanding where this country has come from. We can begin, when students begin understanding Christianity and the history of Christianity, let's say, they begin understanding why certain discourses make sense for certain populations, right? And so these kinds of questions are always embedded in the humanities. You ask the big questions, and then you go in and you do a minute analysis of a particular situation, a particular either thinker, author, or a particular historical situation. And without knowing that, we're going to continue to just simply react, to what's going on today. We're just reacting without any background knowledge of how something came to be what it is now.
Yeah, you're definitely a historian. That's historical context,
for sure.
That
for sure.
I'm glad I took. I'm remembering I took a. I don't think I had today. It was a state school, but I took a course on the Bible as an undergraduate at Northern, absolutely loved it. I still have my Dartmouth. I think it's Dartmouth. Yeah, would that be right? Dartmouth Bible paperback scribbled all. The Bible is literature. Basically, is probably what it was. I really like what you just said about, because people can think of religion. Religion is what divides so many people. But you're talking about studying it as a way of understanding intercultural. Not just communication, relations, and I like that.
Well, it's also interesting that given the current situation in the United States, somebody was talking about the British author Julian Barnes.
Oh yeah, sure,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he had a great quote. He said, "I don't believe in God." He grew up in a post-Christian.
Right. I've read some. Europe. Yeah.
Yeah, and so he says, "I don't believe in God, but I miss him." And so the missing, what is it? Quote. What is that lack? What is that need? And he also claimed that when he enjoyed art, he liked religiously inspired art. Why is that? And religion, although of course when I teach, Buddhism or Hinduism or some other tradition, it's not a conventional, I'm not trying to communicate how true it is, but I want to give, it's kind of like case studies for the students. The ways other people make sense of the world, find a sense of identity and grounding and connections with community. And so they can have, they can begin seeing, oh, the different cultural ways of doing this. And given that we are in a sort of, quote unquote, well, this is an old term, right? Multicultural situation here. They can even utilize some of that, right?
You can even at Gustavus. Yeah, I mean, even where not all students are Lutheran, we know that, mm-hmm, or even, mm-hmm, even Christian. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all fantastic. Now, are you, I don't know if I know the answer to this as long as I've known you, but are you a practicing Buddhist yourself?
I would say yes, overall, in terms of my outlook on life and how I try to treat people and never live up to these ideals. But in that sense, I used to be a Zen Buddhist, and I used to belong to a Zen center way back when. But I don't have any group right now. I don't see Buddhism now so much as a religious identity, but more like a way of life.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like actually my wife, Kate, Judaism for her, I think, is similar. Yeah.
Yeah, there are there are ways of just, understanding the world in a way that I try to be generous.
Oh, you are.
Because of Buddhism, they really focus on compassion, but also discernment, not this sort of naive compassion, obviously, because there are dangers out there and, certain things we need to do, but ways of dealing wisely, but compassionately with other
everyone,
people in the world.
John, everyone, and I'm not just saying this because I'm speaking with you. Everyone who knows you, more than passingly, knows that that's true of you. I mean, I've seen you at faculty meetings. You're welcome. Maybe I need to be embrace Buddhism. Maybe all faculty, because we've all seen you at faculty meetings where you're saying something that's, maybe difficult to say, but the way you're saying it, difficult for people to hear, maybe not so much to say, but the way you're saying it is, calm, it's insightful, it's so, it's all, and it's generous. You are generous.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Quite welcome. Yeah. Well, thank you for being generous with your time here.
Oh, sure.
And we have to continue to be continued over, I don't know, do you drink coffee or tea or both or none? Yeah. All right.
I drink coffee. Yeah.
To be continued over coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love
me too. I really enjoyed, I got to know more about you. So, so much fun. Thank you so much. We're almost at the mid semester, not quite, but good luck to both of us. We're getting there. Yeah. All right, John. Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah. Oh my God. I really appreciate it. It was really fun and interesting. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. All right. See you. Bye-bye. Learning for Life at Gustavus is supported by the Offices of Marketing and Communication and the Provost. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus itself.